When it comes to your finances, go for the credit card that's always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. Real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary, discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now. This is Star Talk, Cosmic Queries Edition, and today's subject is extremophiles and alien worlds. One of my favorite subjects. Chuck, what do you think about that topic?
Kind of sounds like aliens gone wild. Call right now. It's aliens gone wild. You've never seen aliens like this before. Extremophiles.
I love me this little bit of this subject, and but we have one of the world's experts on it on Star Talk today, Kenda Lynch. Kenda, welcome to Star Talk.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Excellent. You have a PhD in this stuff. But let me just alert people that your expertise is some kind of amalgam of whole fields that were previously distinct from one another. Because I think of geology, and I think of biology, and I think of modern astrophysics, and you just took a big fat stapler and crammed them together, and then you do all three of these all at once. How is that even possible?
It's called astrobiology.
No, but you got to know your geology too, right?
You do have to know it's kind of this interesting thing where you just got to learn to wear a lot of hats, and you don't necessarily, you should have, I mean, ultimately you have expertise in one thing a little bit more than the other, but you have to know enough about the others to kind of pull those pieces in, because ultimately they all are really interconnected. And you also have to know when you don't know something and pull in the right people to work with you, but you have to be able to speak their language. So having that understanding of geology, so I can talk to a hard rock geologist about, you know, how I think my bugs are eating their rock, you know, is important. And being able to have the same, you know, same conversation about it is really important.
Yeah, let me tell you something. This is why I love being on this show. It's the only time you will ever hear somebody say, and I have to talk to them about how their bugs are eating my rocks.
Did not see that sentence coming.
I did not either.
But Kenda, you work on Earth. Mm-hmm. So why, what does that have anything to do with aliens on other worlds?
Well, I mean, the reality is when we're trying to understand life in the universe right now, we only have one data point, and that's Earth. So, you know, we have to kind of work on Earth and try to understand life here. And really, when we think about it, it's a big question. How did life even come to be on Earth? How did Earth come to be this big cradle where there's lots of life just kind of crawling all over it and in it and everywhere?
And let me help you with that, Kenda. Bugs started eating rocks.
Chuck is not going to shake that sentence for the next 5 years. He's going yum yum yum, tasty rocks. Yes.
But when we really try to understand looking for life in the universe, you know, a logical first question, and especially since we've tried and hadn't been too successful in the past looking for life on other planets, was, well, how well do we understand life here on Earth? Do we understand the extent of where life can live on Earth? do we understand how life arose on Earth and kind of what did early life look like on Earth and you know, where can we go to look for it and what kind of environments did it live in? And those are a lot of the questions.
Okay, I'm an old man here. When I learned about this, it was we need the 72-degree tide pool for life to thrive on Earth.
That's
how old I am.
One of the things that we have learned.
Life is not comfortable unless it's room temperature.
And it needs just the right amount of sugars, and it needs the special kind of media. No. What we have learned is.
Every once in a while, life is just like, who touched that thermostat?
That's exactly right.
Now, which one of y'all touched that thermostat?
On its Barco lounger. It's
That would be us as a life. We're the ones that kind of need to, we are the ones that glamp, right? But microbial life, man, every time we think we got those bugs figured out, they do something crazy. And we're like, wait, what do you mean you can live on a nuclear reactor? Wait. What do you mean you can live 2 kilometers down in the subsurface, and we find you when we're mining for gold? What do you mean
live in
super hot water that's also salty and acidic? What do you mean? So,
okay, wait a minute. 3 sentences ago, you used the word glamp. Could you please, for anyone over 50, could you just tell people what that word means,
please? It's like camping, but glamour camping, like bringing your house with you camping. So you maybe have like... You're not really camping. You're in the wild, but not really, because maybe you like tow a big old like, trailer with you, and that's your camper. You know,
if you can still watch HBO in your trailer, you're not camping.
Yeah, basically, you know, if you've got a hot tub and you know, and you've got your Keurig or your Tassimo or your what's the other
right.
one? You got that making your right. coffee. You're not camping.
That's why okay. I camp at the Ritz-Carlton.
There you go.
Okay, so you're a staff scientist at the storied Lunar and Planetary Science Institute. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Is that no? Just Lunar and Planetary Institute.
Lunar
is that what they call
Institute,
it?
Correct. Yes.
Right. And that's based in Houston, mm-hmm. Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. And we're especially interested in you today because you're featured in episode 2 of Netflix's docu-series, what's it called? Alien Worlds.
Yes.
So pick up the action for us. Where do we find you?
You find me, as far as in the episode, right when we open up right in the beginning, you see this alien landscape that kind of looks, in my opinion, it looks like Mars. But we're actually in the Dalal Hydrothermal System, which is in the Danakil Depression in Ethiopia. And the Danakil Depression...
So hydrothermal, this would be heat emerging from Earth's crust.
Correct.
Manifesting on the surface somehow.
Yeah, hydrothermal,
right?
Meaning that it's heat coming from the Earth's subsurface, and in this case, a hydrothermal system usually meets heat generated waters, like geo-generated water manifesting up in the surface. So there's water flowing in the subsurface, passing over usually like what we call a magma pocket, which is a big pocket of lava, and there's water flowing over it, getting superheated and then pushing up to the Earth's surface and boiling out and spewing out all sorts of hot gases and everything like that. And that's called a hydrothermal system.
So at those high temperatures, does it absorb a lot of minerals from the rocks that it passes through?
It does. It absorbs a lot of minerals. So there's a lot of what we call anions and cations. There's a lot of dissolved constituents, chemical constituents. And especially in the Dalal system, it also goes through a subsurface salt deposit. So not only is it getting minerals from like the ground, the subsurface rock, like over the magma pocket, but it's also picking up all these minerals and dissolving all these salt minerals. And so Dalal is amazing because it's hydrothermal, really hot, and super salty, hypersaline. And it's also acidic because there's also all this iron and sulfur that make it super acidic. So,
and that's where you want to find life.
Yeah, and it's what we call a poly-extreme environment. And it's so amazing. And it's a crazy challenge for life. And yet, you know, there's multiple teams of us working there that are finding evidence for life in this environment. And
okay, so the Dead Sea, mm-hmm. which is a highly salinic body of water, mm-hmm. could only have been named that by people who did not have access to a microscope.
Yeah, because there's a right. lot of life in the Dead Sea. Salt.
No vertebrate fishes.
Kind of get the feeling that the Dead Sea was named because somebody drank it, and then everybody else was like, you see what happened? Yeah. You see what just happened?
There you go.
water all around and not a drop to drink.
Right. There you go.
There you go.
So tell me about that. I read something about there's an algae pool nearby or in some other parts of your work. What's going on there?
In Dalal or in other sites that I work at.
I just have notes that I'm piecing together here. So, just pools of algae in a toxic liquid.
Well,
what's going on there?
Pools of algae. So we have these bubbling pools, right? And they're literally like, you literally have elemental sulfur precipitating out of these waters. And you can see like...
Sulfur. So it stinks.
Oh, it stinks. And it's like, you think the Dead Sea is deadly? Oh no, Dalal's deadly. You'll see when we're walking through there, you literally see if you get too close on the ground, there's so much hydrogen sulfide gas and carbon dioxide gas. And if you get too close.
Wait, you got to tell Chuck what hydrogen sulfide gas smells like.
Rotting eggs.
Listen.
No, you can. He's a comedian. You can do better than that.
I knew what it was, and I'm sitting here. I'm sitting here like.
Holding himself in, trying my best.
You know? You have no idea the amount of restraint I just exercised. I have 15 fart jokes right now that are bubbling up in me.
They're backed up.
That's the wrong way to talk about a fart joke. But
Chuck has the fart jokes backed up in that whole time you're talking about this, Kenda.
I was ready to explode with fart jokes. This is all I'm saying.
Okay, so hydrogen sulfide, H2SO4, is that correct?
H2S, actually.
Oh, just H2S. Oh, H2SO4 is sulfuric acid.
And that's what's in the water, is the H2S. The sulfuric acid is actually, there's H2S, low molarity. So, I mean, well, I don't know. I haven't touched the water, but in other acidic environments, usually the H2S is kind of low molarity because I've also worked in the Rio Tinto acid river system. And so the H2S is pretty low. Like, it's not going to like immediately burn your skin off. You know, you'll get a nice peel though from it.
Okay. So that's the place. If you're going to eat beans, no one will blame you for anything. Cause you got the whole landscape to blame it on.
Yeah, right. Okay. Gonna even
I would
notice.
Do very well there.
Yes.
I would do very well there.
Yeah. Nobody's going
to say. Chuck, for one night only, an evening of fart jokes.
Exactly.
So, hey, so Kenda, where did you grow up?
I'm a Midwestern kid. I grew up in a town called Rockford, Illinois, which is just west of Chicago, about 90 miles. I went into Chicago a lot for, you know, going to see shows and.
Well, just to be clear, if you were just 90 miles west of New York City, mm-hmm. you were across New Jersey into Pennsylvania. So to index your location to be 90 miles in any direction from Chicago. Does that mean there's no other big city you can tell us what you're near?
No, not where I am, because I'm west.
I
was east, I could say, you know, Detroit's not far away.
Detroit.
You know,
Detroit.
If I was east
right.
of
yeah,
Chicago,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
but I'm west. So, no, it's kind of open plains and cornfields and stuff.
Yeah,
north of me, though, is Green Bay. If I head straight north, you'd be in Green Bay in a few hours.
Now we've all heard of Green Bay.
Yeah. I'm a Bears fan, so, you know, let's not go there.
Oh, the Bears. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you, how do you land on extremophiles as a career goal?
Oh, well, you know, this is interesting because I had a different hat on when I started my career. I actually started learning how to try to grow food and keep astronauts alive on other planets. I started out as
that's
a,
cool, too. Both of these are cool.
I started out as a systems engineer working on space station and trying to keep people alive. But in my education, I'm nuts, and I did a dual degree. I literally have two bachelor's degrees, one in engineering, one in biology.
But generally, if you're nuts, you don't have to tell that to other people because it's just completely clear.
It is true. Okay. Yeah. By the way, all you have to do is say, I got two bachelor degrees at the same time, and people will look
That's
at
nuts.
You
okay.
and go, you must be nuts.
Okay.
And so part of, and I like pain, apparently. So, you know, there's that. Part of my training was to also learn about microbes because when trying to grow plants and develop earth microcosms, you have to understand, you know, not only how humans live, but how everything else that's going to interact lives. So I took classes in, you know, aquatic ecology. I took classes in lake ecology. I took classes in plant biology, you know, and I took classes in microbiology. And so.
So at the end of the day, you realized you took two different majors worth of courses. Mm-hmm. Is that what happened there?
Yep.
So what are the two majors? What were the two?
The first one was basically systems engineering. So it was all of, I took a full course of engineering classes, and then I took a full course of general biology classes. And my engineering degree lets me specialize, so I was able to use a couple of my upper-level biology classes for my specialization in engineering. So
Wait. So your PhD, what was the title of your PhD thesis?
A geobiological investigation of the hypersaline sediments of Pilot Valley, Utah, a terrestrial analog to ancient lake basins on Mars.
Wow.
Okay.
That's why I had to read it. Wow. I couldn't remember.
I got to tell you right now, I'm sorry he asked.
I retract the question. Yeah.
The funny thing is my PhD was still an engineering degree. I unintentionally got three engineering degrees along the way.
I'm liking it. Oh, the master's along the way?
Aerospace engineering for my master's.
Okay, so you were totally loaded.
What do you think about, since you're a microbiologist and you were talking about growing food as one of your tasks when you were working on space stations, what do you think about Matt Damon growing poop potatoes on Mars?
Poop potatoes on Mars. We need the final word there.
He would have had some problems with his thyroid because of all the perchlorate in the regolith. So yeah.
Wow. There are some issues. Basically,
okay. Wait, just to be clear. I got to unpack that. Wait a minute. So on Earth we have soil,
right,
which is rich in microbes that participate in the ecosystem.
Yep.
On the moon and on Mars, there is no soil.
Yep, no, there's not.
Whatever the dust is there is like is ground up rock, basically.
Yes. Yes.
And you call it regolith.
We call it regolith because it has not been processed by microbes that we know of. Definitely not on the moon and on Mars, not that we know of. And we're not sure what the origin is of the organic matter that we have found so far on Mars. So we call it regolith because it's not soil like we know it on Earth that has been processed over years by microbes and other life elements. And there's not a significant amount of organic matter making it kind of a...
He would have had a thyroid problem. Mm-hmm. So when they picked him up to save him, he basically would have had a goiter,
probably, or some other crazy issues. His metabolic system would have been having some weird issues because perchlorate, actually kind of competes with iodine to bind on your thyroid, and we know that Mars has an abundance of perchlorate in the regolith, and that's actually something that I'm working on with other scientists. It's kind of funny in my astrobiology life. I'm starting to kind of go back to my human spaceflight roots, and bringing my astrobiology knowledge and my human spaceflight knowledge together as we're getting ready to go back to the moon.
Well, in the next segment, we're going to pick up questions from our fan base, our Patreon fan base. Chuck has all the questions. I haven't seen them. And we're going to find out what the public has to ask you. And they're very, we got good people out there who listen to this show. They're scientifically literate. And they want to get more scientifically literate. And that's what this is all about when Star Talk returns.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
Hey, remember when we did that show about the science of the golf swing? Well, let's take that to the next level. And that's because PXG has developed the Black Ops Driver so golfers don't have to sacrifice distance for forgiveness. And the science proves it. PXG Black Ops Driver is a breakthrough in driver technology. It's a complete and total victory in golf club engineering, unlike anything you've ever seen before. Black Ops Drivers are adjustable to deliver a combined MOI of 10,000 plus for unreal forgiveness. Now that's ridiculously high. The higher the MOI, the more forgiving the club will play. So you don't have to square the ball perfectly for it to go straight and get distance. Add PXG's new advanced material face technology and you get incredible ball speed that pushes the distance to the absolute limits. More forgiveness, more distance, no sacrifices. PXG Black Ops Driver. Hit your tee shot straighter and farther. The proof is in the science. Learn more and get free shipping on all equipment. Go to pxg.com/startalk and use code startalk at checkout. That's pxg.com/startalk. Use code startalk for free shipping on all equipment. pxg.com/startalk, code startalk.
Hey, I'm Roy Hill Percival, and I support StarTalk on Patreon. Bringing the universe down to Earth, this is StarTalk with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
We're back, StarTalk, Cosmic Queries. We're talking about extremophiles and alien worlds with one of the world's experts on that and apparently a whole lot of other stuff, too. We've got Kenda Lynch, who is a scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston, and who specializes in bugs on Earth that do the backstroke in high temperature, high acid, high everything else that would kill us post-haste. And we're loving it. Kenda, also, where might we find you on social media?
I am on Twitter and I am on Facebook. I have an Instagram, but I need to use it more. But I'm MarsGirl42 on Twitter for sure.
Whoa.
Thank you.
Cool. Hey, cool.
It's a good one.
And you can also find me on the LPI website as well.
Okay. The Lunar Planetary Institute. Okay. Very cool. So Chuck, this is a Cosmic Queries. So we put out the call. And so what did you get?
Well, we got a bunch of people who actually, believe it or not, are super interested in this subject.
No, I believe it. I believe it. It's like weirdly interesting. You know?
It really is. Okay. It really is. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's start off with our favorite. This is Violetta and her mom. It says, hello.
Ain't that child grown up by now? Is she in college by now? Violetta? She used to write it when she was like 11 and 12. And well, no, when she was 11 and 11 and a half.
Yep.
And 12 and 12 and a half.
Okay, well, here we go. This is, hi, Neil. Hi, Chuck. Hi, Kenda. Violetta here, the 13 and a half year old.
He's up to 13 and a half. He's a full up teenager. All okay.
Right. So you said it, Neil. She did 11 and then 12, 12 and a half. Now she's 13 and a half.
And a half. All right.
Okay. She says, I'm writing in from Washington, D.C., and my question is, what is the most surprising, fascinating life form or trait about a life form here on Earth that you have discovered or learned about in your career so far? How did this impact the way you think about what life might look like elsewhere in the universe? Thanks, guys. And I just want to say to Dr. Lynch that the world needs more scientists that look like you. By that, she means... fabulous.
looking fabulous. Fabulous.
And she says, thank you so much for doing and being an inspiration.
Thank you so much, Violetta. So, oh my gosh, there's so many crazy.
Dude, what's the weirdest bug out there? You probably have posters that rank them weirdest to Don't tell me that you don't know what your answer is.
I'll give you my number one favorite because I just think it's so crazy. The thought of it is just so crazy. My favorite bug is the one that can live on nuclear reactors. It's literally
this, and does it have a name?
Yes, and I'm trying to remember the name.
It's not the tardigrade.
It's not the tardigrade.
It's not the tardigrade because the tardigrade is not. It's a small organism, but it's a multicellular organism.
But tell us more about it. So it can live like inside a nuclear reactor.
They found it living on nuclear reactors. It could take these high doses of radiation, and it's got this cool shape. It's actually kind of like a cube almost shape. And that's what
In Japan, those things turn into Godzilla.
I was going to say.
That's how you got all of those Japanese monsters.
You're talking about a Marvel origin story right now.
Yes.
The name will come to me and I'll spit it out at some point later.
Okay.
I know I will.
All right. So you like the radiation resistance
I just think it's amazing that, again, it's this whole thing about every time we think we got bugs figured out, like, okay, here's their radiation limit. Here's their life water limit. Here's their cold limit. Here's their hot limit. And then bugs are like, yeah, no. And they blow us right away. And they're like, nah, we figured out
this.
A way.
Yeah, we got this. All right. So is this a single-celled organism?
Yes, this is a single-celled organism. Yes.
Got it. Okay. Whereas the tardigrade is a whole macroscopic object with legs and...
Right. It's a multicellular organism, but it's still small and it's still something that has amazing resilience and can survive incredible, incredible environments. So I'd be excited if we could find something like the tardigrade, like on another planet, because it definitely has developed strategies to live in crazy environments. It kind of basically desiccates itself and like goes dormant and goes into like they call it a water bear. So it goes into hibernation, this really crazy, like dehydrated hibernation, and it can survive all sorts of insane environments, including being exposed to space.
Oh man, there's a whole episode of Star Trek Discovery devoted to a space tardigrade that they find that helps them navigate the mycelium network. And the cosmic mycelium network is this thing that allows you to move faster than light because you enter this network that kind of transports you almost instantaneously to different locations throughout the universe.
I love it. I love it. They found a tardigrade in there.
Who would have thought tardigrades were also spacefaring? Well, if they came from space initially, that's the big thing there.
Well. Yeah.
Cool. Let's get the next question. Chuck, what else you got?
All righty, let's do it. Here we go. This is, Nander Sirkel. Okay.
Okay.
All right, that's your name now, man.
take it or leave it. Okay.
Here we go. He says, I often wonder, when we're looking for life out there, aren't we a bit biased by our own conditions for life itself? Like water or breathable air. Even when considering silicon life forms, this still assumes creatures living on planets. Do you think it would be reasonable to consider, for example, other scales of life in size and space-time? Maybe some life forms would be the size of planets, even galaxy or quantum particles moving in time so fast that we, as slowpokes, can't even see them.
Whoa. Wow. So, Kendra, what part of your PhD thesis dealt with quantum
life forms?
Not much of it, but I'll tell you, I was a fan of Star Trek Next Generation, so I'm there with this person's questions, you know? But quantum life forms. So, not part of that. But in astrobiology, we really do think about what we call as life as we don't know it. Or what some people like to call weird life. And we try to think when we're looking for life, we're developing this way to try to think what we call agnostically about life, which means so life as we don't know it or weird life. So yeah, there's the problem. We only have one data point, Earth, and life on Earth has these.
And even your extremophiles are part of that one data point.
Even though they're extreme and they can live on radio, live on reactors or breathe iron or, you know, eat other crazy, you know, metals and things like that.
Rocks.
Eat rocks, yeah. And even though they can do these crazy things, they all still have the same amino acids as we do. They have the same stereochemistry as we do. And we all have the same fundamental, basically, code. We have DNA and RNA. We all have the same fundamentals. We all have that same base code of life that kind of builds the structure of life. When we think about life on another planet, we have to think about life as we don't know it. What if they use a completely different stereochemistry? What if they use a different set of amino acids to build their proteins? What if they have a different liquid? I was just getting asked this in a previous conversation about, you know, what about Titan, where we have lakes of methane? It's a fluid, and life needs fluid for a chemistry. And
Titan, Saturn's largest moon. Titan, yep. Yeah, where we've actually been there.
And
yeah,
we're sending a beautiful little helicopter that's going to go and land and study the surface and those lakes and some of the organic sands there and try to understand the possibility for prebiotic chemistry on Titan. And that's the question, is prebiotic chemistry possible in, you know, that kind of environment? And what would it look like? And what could life look like being, you know, arising in that kind of environment? So, yeah.
One of my favorite New Yorker comics was there's a crashed flying saucer in the desert, and these two aliens are just crawling along the sands. And one says to the other, ammonia, ammonia.
Totally. I mean, that's totally it, right? I mean, on Earth, it just happened that water was the thing that was going to be, you know, the basis for life's chemistry. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's how it's going to work on other planets. And that's something that we do have to think about. And then thinking about the larger scale of life, we do have scientists that are, you know, they look at things called technosignatures. So we try to understand the scale of, you know, contacting other intelligent, you know, what we call intelligent, I mean, forms of life. Don't get me started on the intelligent comment, you know, I don't know.
We're not even that yet.
Thank you.
The jury's still out on us.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So
can I ask both of you this?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a finite chemistry in the universe? I know we have the periodic table. Is there anything that could be outside of that that could actually contribute to life that is not on our periodic table?
No.
That can't
be. Next question. No.
everything that we know. Now, there may be other elements that we haven't discovered just because we haven't discovered them yet, but no. I mean, because all life begins with stars. You know, all of our elements come from stars. So the star stuff, that's the one common thing that makes it possible for us to really think about this question is that
that's the ingredients in the kitchen are all the same.
The ingredients in the kitchen are the same across the universe. So that's helpful.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just
the recipe.
Chuck,
we're doing better than that because we have created elements that the universe has never seen before in our laboratories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we created two dozen more elements about 20 more elements than are currently there. So let me ask you this, Kenda. If chemistry is the same, and basically geology is the same, right? You put a geologist on a planet, oh, I know what rock this is, or we might have a different kind of minerality, but it won't be so foreign to them that they'll be befuddled.
Right.
Is there any reason, and the physics is obviously the same. So if I have the same physics, the same chemistry, the same geology, why can't we think that maybe biology will all focus towards the same forms as we have here if everything else does that in the other branches of science?
Well, I mean, that's a loaded question because it's not, we can expect some of the same principal things to happen. Like there's going to be some kind of cell wall structure. There's going to be an encoding system. There's going to be some way to transfer information. There's going to be some way to move energy and generate energy. There's going to be some way to move things in and out of an interior environment. Those kind of things, yeah, we can kind of figure out that those kind of are the common elements that are going to make life happen for biology. And those are the kind of things that we agree. We actually kind of agree there's a common set of about eight things that all life, you know, anything that we call life would probably have going on. Now, how they get it and how they put it together, that's where that chemistry is different. And that's where the environmental context that made the geology is probably different. You know,
that's going to be,
and that's where, and that's where maybe some of the physics, because the gravity is a little different. So some things are slightly different that help, you know, drive that environmental context. So does that make sense?
I can say that you're not going to expect life forms the size of galaxies.
No.
Well, okay.
Can I tell you why? I'll tell you why.
Why?
Okay. Okay, so our galaxy is 100,000 light years across. Okay, 100,000. If that were a life form, and one part of it had an itch, how long would it take to scratch that itch? If you can't move faster than the speed of light. So it has an itch, and then it brings one part of it to over to the other part to scratch it. 100,000 years later, it scratches the itch. This is not very effective.
Right.
This is not a coherently functioning organism.
Right. Right.
Exactly.
And if evolution requires a lot of experimenting, mm-hmm. then the life form has to be able to change either on purpose or by accident fast enough so that you can have enough of these experiments for it to take on interesting
exactly.
forms.
Yeah.
And if you're really, really big, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, because I mean...
And if it takes 100,000 years to scratch an itch, just imagine how uncomfortable it would be when its underwear gets stuck in its butt.
Okay.
I'm more thinking about the size of the underwear at this point, you know, so just like...
I know.
Sorry.
just to be clear, I wear boxer briefs, and boxer briefs don't get stuck in your butt.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, look at just so you, you know. Sexy bragging.
So let's see if we can squeeze one more in before the break.
All righty, let's do it. Here we go. This is Akilisha Kashyap. Man, y'all just messing with me now, man. That ain't a real name.
No.
Okay, it's A-K-H-I-L-E-S-H. Akilesh Kashyap. K-A-S-H-Y-A-P. Kashyap, I hope. Okay.
Okay.
Hello, Dr. Tyson. Hello.
I'll give you a B-minus on that one.
I get an A-minus? Okay.
A B-minus.
Oh, B-minus. Okay. Damn, you just keep... I keep going down. Before you know it, it's just like you're expelled. Hello, Dr. Tyson. Hello, Dr. Lynch and Lord Nice. Oh, okay. I am a first-time Patreon member.
Nice.
And my question is, if we discover life on a restricted body like Europa or Enceladus, are we allowed to study them only through orbiting satellites? Or can we bring something back home and cut them open for science, of course? I mean, you went dark there. You went dark at the end, bro. Okay? You started off with...
Real good.
You started off with our continuing mission. To seek out new life, new civilizations, and then you ended up with, let's just cut these suckers open.
Well, be careful. There's some folks around where Kendra hangs out in Texas where... Can we bring it back and barbecue?
Yeah, yeah.
We will get to that answer after the break on Star Talk Cosmic Queries with astrobiologist Kendra Lynch.
Do you want to set up your child for success? Of course you do. Maybe you want to save money on private tutoring, or maybe it's just out of your budget altogether. Is this a big school year for your child? Like maybe they're starting kindergarten, middle school, or high school, or some other milestone. Maybe your family moved and they're starting at a new school. Is your child ahead? Not getting challenged enough in class? Well, we love that little smarty, but we want them to be engaged. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or the personality. There's one site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids can use it at home on the computer or on the go through the app on your phone or your tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything itself. And no more trying to figure out how to explain math equations or grammar rules yourself. IXL has built-in explanation videos. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And StarTalk Radio listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/StarTalk. Visit IXL.com/StarTalk to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
We're back for the third and final segment of Star Talk Cosmic Queries. Kenda Lynch is with us, who's an expert in microbes on Earth as possible analogs to microbes in the universe. So, Kendra, over the break, you remembered this radioactivity loving microbe.
Yes.
The name of it. What's it called?
It's called Deinococcus radiodurans, and they literally can live on. They found them on nuclear reactors, and they are very,
Deinococcus.
Deinococcus. Yes.
Radiodurans. This sounds like a rock group.
It does.
But doesn't it?
It really does, you know?
Chicago, are you ready? Deinococcus radiodurans.
Rock it out.
Wow, that's cool.
Okay, so we left off with a question about, what was it, Chuck?
So he wants to know that if we discover life on a restricted body, mm-hmm. like Europa, yes. or Enceladus.
It's protected by NASA laws, basically.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, can we actually study it just through satellites orbiting, or can we bring back something and cut it open?
Okay. Well, I mean... Wow.
Well, let me just back up for mm-hmm. a second. So NASA has a department mm-hmm. of planetary protection,
right.
and there's a code within them, which is not a computer code, but a behavioral code. Whereas there are these selected objects in the solar system that may have life. We don't mess with them, or if we do, we go in a highly sterilized way. And if we bring anything back to Earth, we want to keep that quarantine to make sure it doesn't kill us. That's their job.
Yeah, and that's the Planetary Protection Office. And the answer is, we're moving into this phase of science where we are trying to bring things back because we realize that we need to bring things back to be able to study them better, to understand if there's life in them or not. Right now, we're in the process with the Perseverance rover in Jezero Crater for the Mars 2020 mission. They're caching samples that we're going to send a lander to go and pick up those samples and hand them off for the rover, and we're going to bring those samples back to Earth from Mars. And we actually have missions that are being developed to go to try to land on both Europa and Enceladus. And Enceladus is my favorite. It's one of my favorite icy moons, by the way. I love Enceladus. To try to understand, to look at the surface and maybe eventually try to get a sample that came up from the subsurface ocean on both of those planets, that we can study in situ. And maybe someday we can figure out how to bring those back. But right now, the goal is to just try to get to land on the surface and try to study samples in situ to see if we can find evidence for possible biosignatures of life.
I may be mistaken with this question, but I'm just going to ask it. Did we not learn from Carolyn Porco, that they're mm-hmm. going to try to fly something through one of the plumes
yes.
of Enceladus and maybe collect
yes.
what's being, pushed out of the ice?
Yeah, we have a mission that's going to try to do that. I Well, we also have a Europa Clipper that's going back to Europa. That might even be able to do that with Europa Clipper. But we're also trying to fly through the plumes of Enceladus. We have the Enceladus Orbilander concept that is looking at doing that, like orbiting, but also sending a lander down to the surface to pick up, to do some in situ science on the surface of Enceladus, hopefully near one of the Tiger Claws where all this stuff is spewing out.
Okay, so that's the third time you said in situ.
Sorry.
In five sentences.
In situ means...
In situ, excuse me, Madam Latin there. Okay.
Sorry, Latin, that's all science, especially biology. We like throwing Latin around everywhere.
You've thrown to a Latin.
Everything has
just,
a Latin
just
name.
Give me some Latin.
Everything has a Latin name in biology.
Yeah, it's Latin. So let me emphasize something that I think you said, but just wafted by it. The ice on Europa is very thick, but it also cracks, and then water seeps up in the cracks and refreezes. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be astrophysically lazy, and instead of trying to dig through the ice, you're going to try to see if there's anything that came up through the ice and froze there that requires no digging at all.
Well, I mean, it might require some digging for the subsurface, but there are, we have some really brilliant scientists, not me, but some of my colleagues that are really brilliant that study the kind of the ice.
Other brilliant scientists.
other brilliant scientists, not me, because I don't study ice dynamics. I'm the biology one, but they study kind of that geology of those ice dynamics, and they found that there is likely water that is seeping up from the ocean and kind of connecting in the shallow subsurface and doing things that they can actually see on the surface from remote sensing.
And if that water below the surface had life, it would have gurgled up and frozen in place. Right. You'd have freeze-dried life to study.
Yeah, exactly, if we can access some of those areas where that life probably kind of gurgled up. And then on Enceladus, of course, we've got, the Tiger Claws just spewing, stuff out into space, so we can try to capture some of that. And then we can also land on the surface to try to see what we can see that maybe kind of fell back down. If anything,
Okay, so how sterilized do your probes have to be to land on a protected body?
Oh, very sterile. that's the challenge of doing this, is that, you've got to make sure not only that the lander is very sterile, but that, all the instruments that you're working on are very sterile.
Everything. Everything.
They're even working on concepts.
A coronavirus found on...
Just make the lander wear a mask.
That's all, everything.
It's just like, make sure you wear your mask,
and
lander.
Use hand sanitizer, right?
Use hand sanitizer and show us your vax card before you touch that.
All right, Chuck, give me another one. Another question, Chuck.
All right. Before, you know what? I got to ask this just before we go. I know I'm not a Patreon. So when you talk about this water underneath this, basically, this planet, you got the ice like a crust and then the water underneath, but then you have other bodies in space that are just frozen solid pieces of water. Why doesn't the planet just freeze all the way down? Why is there water underneath that ice that can
On the moon?
On the moon. Yeah. It's not the planet. I'm sorry.
Why do we have these ocean worlds on moons around Jupiter?
On moons.
Well, first of all, a couple of different things. First of all, we get heating from the gravity, the extreme gravity that causes what we call tidal heating. And Neil could probably explain that better, that kind of pushes and flexes and causes heating that kind of adds some heating to the planet and keeps it warm. Plus, these waters have lots and lots and lots and lots of salt, that are depressing the freezing point. So the water is able to stay liquid because there's so much salt in it that freezing point gets lowered because there's so much salt in it keeping it liquid.
It's been rumored that zero on the Fahrenheit scale is the freezing temperature of a supersaturated solution of brine, of salt water. It's been rumored. And so that's where you get a zero. That's the coldest liquid they could get that would freeze. And then regular water just freezes at the warmth of 32 degrees on the Fahrenheit scale. But you said it perfectly, Kenda. Just the tidal stress between Jupiter and the tugs of other surrounding moons are pumping energy in. And so now there's a heat source that has nothing to do with the sun. I learn in my biology books, you need sunlight for life. What you really need is just energy.
Need energy.
You take the physics angle on it. You just need energy. And you pump energy in from tidal forces. You got it.
And what they think is going on in Enceladus is they actually think that heat is also generating kind of, and maybe some residual heat, but probably more of the tidal forces on Enceladus, generating heat that's causing hydrothermal hydrothermal vents, like what we see on Earth, you know, the deep sea hydrothermal vents with the black smokers and things that you see like on the National Geographic videos. They think that that's what they're seeing in the in Enceladus, and that's kind of what's kind of helping to kind of possibly generate the tire claws, pushing that energy out. And that is creating a lot of cool chemistry that life could take advantage of.
So, Kendra, we've had Natalie Starkey on the show, who wrote a book recently on all the cool, literally and figuratively, things in the universe. Volcanoes, hot and cold, and she describes Enceladus as an ice volcano.
Yeah, cryovolcanism.
And the plumes are just where you just need extra pressure buildup. It didn't have to be hot compared to us. It could just be pressure in its own environment, even if it's very cold. So, very cool. Chuck, keep it coming.
Yeah, you can't keep it better coming than that. That's so cool. Cryovolcanism.
Yes.
If that doesn't make you love science, you're dead inside.
I know. You know? I want that on my business card.
Exactly.
I'm a cryovolcanist. You know, what are you? Okay.
All right, here we go. This is William D.A. Thank you, William. Thank you. He says, given that humans have always been fighting a war with tiny bacteria, viruses, and prions, etc., how likely do you think it is that there's a planet out there with a tiny microscopic organism and it wiped out the more complex life? What would such a planet look like long term? And that's what he said. So if we're in a war, if we all got killed by a virus here, then what happens long term, even if it's just here on Earth?
Yeah, ultimately, do all the little things kill all the big things? And you just have a planet full of viruses or single-celled organisms? Yeah. Where does the biology go? Right.
Hey, what's up, Corona? Right. What's up, Streptococcus?
Hey, rhinovirus, how you doing today? Yeah, everybody's just chilling.
All the viruses.
They got cities and things.
Yeah. Get out of here, herpes.
You weren't invited to the party.
You got invited, man.
You know, given that we've already had multiple mass extinction events on the planet already, not necessarily microbes have taken out our bigger organism, but something else, usually an asteroid or something else, took out our larger organisms. Life has just kind of rebounded, and for a while the little guys were, you know, the little guys were in charge, but life eventually kind of picked back up, and organisms got more. You know, there's an advantage on Earth for multicellularity, and so life eventually kind of worked its way back to multicellularity at some point. You know, and those small guys got bigger and bigger and more complex each time. But what I would say is if we had a microbe-generated mass extinction event, my guess is, for a while, the little guys would be in charge. But then eventually, depending on, the environment of Earth, if it's advantageous to take advantage of resources and to keep yourself alive, to become multicellular, life would probably go back to being multicellular or having a multicellular component on the planet.
That's an excellent argument, because if we've done it multiple times in the past, why not again? I mean, after the KT... Yeah. Extinction, nothing bigger than, a suitcase or
like
something,
rats and like small rodents.
Yeah, a duffel bag, which is the biggest size life form. And now we have, the blue whale swim in the ocean, the largest animal there ever was. So a very good argument there. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
That's very cool. Very
cool. Chuck, we got time for like one more, I think. What do you got?
All right. Let's go to Kevin, the sommelier.
Ooh.
Kevin says.
I like Kevin.
Yes.
Kevin, we're going to party with you, Kevin.
Exactly. Kevin says, when I'm sitting around drinking a Chateau Neuf de Pop, I often...
No.
I just threw that in there.
Okay.
I thought that'd be cool.
All right. That was cool.
I wish he did start like that. Kevin says, astrobiology used to be termed exobiology. Was this just a rebranding to make people more interested in it, like when Coke introduced New Coke, but had to go back to classic Coke? Well, keep drinking up, Kevin the Sommelier.
That's a very good question that I'm thinking about here, because, you know, the reality is that when I fell in love with this, it was exobiology. When I was, and I'm not going to date myself, but when I got my first lecture, it was from this gentleman named Donald DeVincenzi, who was a part of what was called the exobiology office at NASA. And FYI, NASA always had an exobiology office. NASA started with an exobiology office. So this has been a question that NASA has wanted answered since the beginning of NASA. So this has been kind of part of our charter from the beginning. And so I think the big transition came, obviously, after the Viking results, but I think the big transition came after the Allen Hills Rock and the discovery of the organics in the Allen Hills Rock and, you know, the hypothesis that these were organics were made by Martian microbes and these kind of microbes made these special, you know, the whole argument about the biogenicity of the organic structures in the
Allen Hills. The Allen Hills Rock is about the size of a Idaho potato, been sitting on the shelf for years. It was, we knew it was a meteorite, but no one really knew much about it until, like you said, the Viking mission. We have accurate measurements of the atmosphere of Mars from that mission, and air pockets trapped in that rock matched that air exactly. Yes. And oh my gosh, a rock from Mars sitting on the shelf.
The age of SNC rocks, meteorites was born.
I never mind looking ignorant because it's my specialty. Please tell me what the Allen Hills Rock is.
The Allen Hills is a Mars meteorite. We know, as Neil said, that it came from Mars because we look at these little bubbles in it that keep gases in it, and we're able to extract the gas and look at the gas composition, and it tells us that it has the exact same composition of the gases on Mars from our Viking results. And so we know that this meteorite was a piece of Mars that got blasted off and traveled to Earth and kind of landed on Earth. And so Allen Hills is one of what we call an SNC or a Mars meteorite that came from Mars. And
cool.
Just for background, there's a set of hills in Antarctica called the Allen Hills, where the glacier that is like permanently on Antarctica for now, as it migrates, it comes up against the hills. And if any rock fell from space and landed on this glacier, it gets dragged to these hills and deposited there. So it's a really convenient way to scoop up meteorites without having to comb thousands of square miles of area. You let the glacier do it for you. So it's in Allen Hills, and it was found in 1984.
Right. Wow.
And they still do. And they do still do annual trips, or they had been. I don't know if they stopped because of COVID for a while, to Antarctica to go out and look on the glaciers for meteorites. Because anywhere else, you actually have to watch it fall to go, kind of go look for it, or you have to, you know, and we have people send us rocks, especially at the LPI all the time. I think it's a meteorite, and it's not.
Oh. Yeah, it's here we call the meteor wrongs.
Yeah, exactly, the meteor wrongs. Yeah, exactly.
No, the point is, is it most? Certainly, possibly as much as half of all meteorites in our collections come from these ice sheets. Mm-hmm. And people wonder, well, do the meteors aim for the ice sheets? No, that's the only place you would find them if they fell. Otherwise, you have to sift through countless other rocks in the forest to know which one came from space and which
didn't.
And
most of the ones that are verified that weren't fallen on the glacier is because somebody watched it fall and tracked it. And that's
exactly.
So, but the point is that after, you know, we got Allen Hills, and this was back in, I think it was 92, 93, is that right? When this study came out and they thought that this happened, and everybody, you know, kind of disagreed, and we had, you know, arguments back and forth about are they life, are they not life? And then we realized, do we really understand what life is? And this is about the time that we started learning about, you know, we started learning more about extremophiles and the RNA world, the vastness of the RNA world. And we started learning more about biotechnology and our capabilities for, higher sample resolution and sample detectability, in our instruments got higher. So all of this kind of stuff made us start to question.
When instruments got more sensitive.
Yes, thank you, more sensitive. Mm-hmm. Can't find my words today.
That's fine. Okay.
all of these things kind of together, kind of, you know, with that Allen Hills discovery, and at that time they went back and looked at the Viking results and realized that Viking would not have necessarily caught everything because of the sensitivity wasn't high enough, right? So there's all of these things going on. We started asking the question, like, what do we really know about life? Do we really understand life on Earth? Do we really understand the extent of life or what is alive on Earth? And so that's where astrobiology, because it was looking, exobiology was like looking for life elsewhere, but astrobiology includes understanding how life on Earth also came to be. How did we become to be a living planet? So that's where the new term astrobiology came from, because it became about looking for life on Earth, looking for life in the universe, but also trying to understand how did we become the data point that we have now.
So I take the meta view, which is everything the astrophysicist does in space has a counterpart here on Earth. And so you want to glue together astro in front of each of those words. So we have astrochemistry, astrobiology, astroparticle physics. We're the push cart for
right,
it all.
There you go. I like that one too.
funny how the astrophysicists become the quarterback of the team.
I'm just saying. Yeah, there you go.
We got appointed by the universe itself that role.
Come on now.
So, Kenda, I remember when that Alan Hill's rock made news. And it was a research paper by some folks at Johnson Space Center making the claim that maybe this has evidence for life, which meant life was on Mars. I remember it like it was yesterday. And there was some chemistry within the rock. And then there was a photo of a worm-looking thing on the surface. And we didn't know what it was. It was really tiny. But it was just kind of intriguing. It made a good headline photo. But the better evidence was from the other chemistry going on in the rock. I was on a talk show to comment on this rock. And they had me, a philosopher, and a biologist. And the philosopher said, how do we know whether the rock itself is not alive? Okay, we got that out of the way. got to make that
stop
comment.
Smoking and weed, then, dude.
We had to get past that. And then... So then they put up the photo of this worm thing, and the biologist says, that can't possibly be life. And I'm thinking, wow, the biologist must know a lot to know that that can't be. So I said, well, how come? And he says, oh, because that's 1/10 the size of the smallest microbes on Earth. And I then said, last I checked, this is from Mars. It was like, and I realized how narrow the thinking was of biologists. Because like you began this program, Kenda, if all you have is a data sample of one, you have no capacity to think differently. Right. Everything has to be shoehorned into your own understanding of the world. And I was perfectly happy to have it be a life form that we don't know anything about. Deal with it.
And that biologist today is working at McDonald's.
I don't remember who that was.
All right.
But I don't know. Probably not.
We got to call it quits there. Kenda, it's been a delight to have you on the show. I remember you when you were in graduate school. You're all grown up now. She's all grown up.
It's such an honor to be here. And I'm so glad that you remember me. And
actually, finally found you in the ether. And we can find you on Netflix, episode 2 of Alien Worlds. And we're loving it. And Chuck, always good to have you there, my co-host.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysicist. Keep looking up.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.